Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call the joint hearing to order, even though Representative Huntley isn't here yet. But we do have a very limited time, and we have a lot of material to cover. And this is material that's of interest to many, many people. And so I want to move us along as best I can here. And so appreciate everyone being here. So this is a joint hearing of the Health and Human Service Policy and Finance Committees. And I had invited other members, at least of the House, and I hope of the Senate, too, to be here. So hopefully other members will be in the room. And this should be of interest to everyone because it's a long-standing issue with an enormous amount of impact both on our public patients in Minnesota and also on our budget. So I'm going to first ask Jim Nobles, our legislative auditor, and his staff to come up to the table, and they are going to give us an orientation to this subject that we're talking about today, which is the history and purpose of the PMAP program, and begin to discuss the audits that they did. And we are going to be shorter on time than I had hoped, and so I hope that you can make a very succinct presentation. What you have to say is very, very important to us, but we have just an enormous... You have many years to cover in a short time, but I just would ask you to be, please, as succinct as you can. And members, we're going to ask members to hold your questions unless they're just absolutely clarifying questions. For example, what does that acronym stand for? If there's something that's preventing you from understanding what's being said, please raise your hand. Otherwise, we'll just keep a list, and we are going to try very hard to reserve time for questions. We are not taking any public testimony today, just so everyone in the room understands that. So everyone should have the agenda, and I'd like to get started. So thank you very much. Mr. Nobles, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and thank you for the invitation to be with you, and we will be succinct. Governments, like the state of Minnesota, as well as private organizations, generally purchase health care in two ways. And I think most of you are quite aware of these two models, but just to kind of, again, get us oriented. Organizations may pay individual providers for each procedure or service that is provided to an eligible client. We call this approach fee-for-service. The other approach is that there may be a prepayment made to what we generally call a health maintenance or health care organization to take care of the health needs of eligible clients. This prepaid health management approach offers at least the possibility of greater coordination of care for the health needs of clients. In addition, it offers the possibility of greater cost control because managed care organizations theoretically have accepted a level of risk that some clients will require more services than the prepayment will cover. Therefore, they have a financial incentive to not overprescribe services or procedures. Health maintenance organizations also have an incentive to prevent fraud and abuse by providers or clients. Minnesota has for several decades embraced the prepayment managed care approach, but we have also continued to use the fee-for-service approach for some services. Both approaches have benefits and advocates, and both approaches impose significant challenges and concerns on the state. As a result, the Office of the Legislative Auditor has examined both approaches in several recent evaluations, and we are here to give you a very brief, high-level summary of what we have found, specifically related to the way the Minnesota Department of Human Services has fulfilled its role in setting the prepayment rates for managed care organizations and overseeing their delivery of health care. I have with me, as you noted, Madam Chair, two evaluators at the Office of the Legislative Auditor who are our real experts on these issues, Joel Alter and Valerie Bombach. Joel and Valerie produced our 2008 report, which is available on our website, and we can certainly make copies available to you. And then Ms. Bombach was the manager of our more recent evaluation, which I think many of you heard, related to medical assistance payment rates for dental services. But before I call on them to give you a summary of what we have found, I want to just highlight 2 points. First, because OLA has done work in this area, we understand the enormous and complex task the state has in designing and implementing policies and procedures to purchase billions of dollars in healthcare services. The work by the legislature and the Department of Human Services that goes into these tasks is truly impressive. Second, I want to note that analysis by OLA and others suggests that the state has in recent years been particularly generous in compensating managed care organizations for their services. But we need to do a better job of ensuring transparency and accountability. There still is insufficient information available to rigorously assess the costs and benefits of the prepayment managed care model. We still depend too much on assumptions and assertions, and not enough on hard evidence. We, like you, remain hopeful that your recent requirements for additional data from managed care organizations will yield more definitive answers about what state taxpayers are actually obtaining and clients are obtaining in terms of services from managed care organizations. And with that, Madam Chair, I would like now to turn to Mr. Alter and Ms. Baumbach to share their thoughts with you about what we've learned from our evaluations. And again, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Alter.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Alter with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And what I'd like to do, again, very briefly, first is give an extremely brief history of Medicaid managed care in Minnesota. Second, to highlight from our 2008 report on financial management of healthcare programs, what we said about whether Minnesota should continue to use managed care in its public programs. And then third, highlight just a couple of brief points that we said in that report about managed care rate setting. So first, a brief history of Medicaid managed care. Minnesota got into this business about 30 years ago. And at that time, the state had several hopes that managed care would result in lower costs, greater access to health care, and better quality health care. Minnesota started very slowly. There was a demonstration project that was authorized by the legislature in 1983. The implementation of that, which started a couple of years later, was in just 3 counties. It was a full decade later, in 1995, that Minnesota got authorization to expand its Medicaid managed care program statewide. In 1999, there was state legislation that required all counties to participate in the state's MA managed care program. And in the interim there, in 1997, something else I think worth noting is that the legislature authorized in law the establishment of county-based purchasing organizations. These are organizations created by counties and that sort of act like HMOs. They can either purchase or provide healthcare services on behalf of enrollees in public programs. And so what you have today is DHS contracting with a combination of private healthcare organizations and public ones to purchase healthcare. One other thing in the history that I think is worth noting is that, like most states, Minnesota initially used managed care to serve a relatively able-bodied subgroup of its lower-income population, that is, families on welfare, through what came to be known as the Prepaid Medical Assistance Program, or PMAP. Since those initial years, Minnesota has added other managed care programs to serve, I think, more challenging populations, for example, requiring low-income seniors to enroll in managed care and offering individuals with disabilities the option of enrolling in managed care. Let me turn next to the question that has arisen about, should Minnesota continue to be in the managed care business? And again, I want to highlight what we said in our 2008 report. First of all, we looked at national research and what researchers have concluded from looking at managed care where it's been implemented in other states. And nationally, the research studies have shown mixed evidence on managed care's effects on cost, quality, and access. For example, regarding cost, there have been a lot of states that have gotten into the managed care business with the expectation of very large cost savings. and frankly, those have not generally materialized. That's not to say that there not have not been cost savings either overall or within certain sectors of healthcare through managed care, but they have generally not been the gigantic savings that some anticipated. There have been a number of studies from both the private and public sector healthcare groups that have documented managed care's contributions to reductions in emergency room use and in other expensive types of healthcare. So it again, just in the cost area, it has been a mixed picture. No big savings, but certainly some smaller progress in holding down costs in certain areas. In Minnesota, contrary to the initial expectations when the demonstration project was started in the early 1980s, Minnesota has never succeeded in comprehensively evaluating whether its Medicaid managed care programs provide health care more cost effectively than fee-for-service. In the years after the demonstration started, state officials concluded and reported in any number of reports and evaluations that it was difficult to compare managed care and fee-for-service. There was, to my knowledge, one pretty conclusive study that was done in 1990 looking at a subpopulation of the managed care population. And for that subgroup, which happened to be mentally ill individuals, the study showed evidence that there were significant cost savings without adverse impacts on patient health, access, or satisfaction. That was a very good study. It was done by the University of Minnesota. But again, there have been a lot of other kind of false starts in trying to look at and arrive at some definitive conclusions about the impact of managed care. After Minnesota expanded the program statewide, there was a study by the Urban Institute. It found no evidence that the expansion of Medicaid managed care to all counties improved client access to care, and that was contrary to the expectations at that time. But that report, too, also said that there was no real hard data on which it could judge the impact of managed care on cost. Nevertheless, in our 2008 report, we did conclude that the state's efforts to provide accountable and client-focused health care, in our view, have been better served by managed care than by fee-for-service. And let me just highlight a few reasons that we came to that judgment. Fee-for-service has sort of operated as a see the doctor and then the state is going to pay the doctor's bill type of delivery approach. And in our view, managed care offered some advantages over that fairly simple, straightforward approach of fee-for-service. Through managed care, there were contracts that provided a mechanism, if the state wished to use them, to leverage improvements in quality or in access or in accountability. As Jim mentioned, the capitation payments that the state agrees to provide a very predictable payment that the state is going to make, whereas fee-for-service payments are not. There has been competition and collaboration among health plans that have fostered some creative efforts to serve enrollees. Health plans have played an important role in assembling some of the provider networks around the state. And in fact, when we did this evaluation in 2008, a number of people commented that some of those networks would simply not be in place had it not been for the efforts of the health plans. Health plans have had incentives to control utilization and improper payments, and arguably they have perhaps done a better job of that even than DHS in the fee-for-service area. And finally, we noted that enrollees have more recourse when things go wrong or when they have concerns or complaints under managed care. There are more avenues that enrollees can go to pursue recourse. So overall, we concluded in that report that while there has not been a solid demonstration of managed care superiority over fee-for-service, it seemed to us that, at least in theory, managed care offered potential benefits to the state that fee-for-service did not, and that Minnesota should continue to rely significantly on managed care to serve enrollees in public programs. I want to offer two other observations that we made in that 2008 report, and these relate to rate setting, which we spent a lot of time addressing in that report, but I want to just boil it down to a couple of messages. We said that DHS set rates for managed care that did enable the health plans to remain financially healthy, and that's a good thing. I mean, certainly the idea here in setting rates is not to drive health plans out of business. We were not convinced in 2008, however, that DHS had done as much as it needed to do to control managed care costs, and that was both in the area of medical costs as well as administrative costs. And we urge DHS to more aggressively scrutinize managed care rates. And certainly some things have happened since that report came out. DHS has, for example, negotiated caps on managed care profits in 2011. There has been competitive bidding, and DHS may want to talk about those later on today. The one other thing that I want to mention from that report is that at the time we did the evaluation, DHS knew very little about the health plan's payments to providers. In fact, interestingly, DHS did not want to know about payments to providers. It was their feeling that if they had information on provider payments, they might be required to disclose that information publicly. And so frankly, they didn't even ask for the information. And we thought that was not a good situation. If DHS was going to be in overseeing and regulating, that it needed to have a lot of information about provider payments. And we recommended that, and we suggested that the legislature authorize that information be classified. And in fact, there have been different iterations of the law since our report, but that is what in fact happened, that DHS allowed that information to be classified, and we're just getting to the point today where DHS is gathering some much richer information on payments to providers. I'll stop there and turn it over to Valerie.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Alter. And Ms. Bombach, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Valerie Bombach, and I was the project manager on the evaluation of medical assistance payment rates for dental services. And for this study, we examined a very narrow slice of the medical assistance program, and we looked in depth at a couple of just a few key issues. Our main research questions were, one, does Minnesota pay reasonable rates for dental services? And two, what has been the impact of payment rates on dentist participation and patient access? And I'll mention here that figuring out how much the state is paying for a particular service or procedure was a bit more challenging than expected, mostly because Minnesota reimburses dental providers through a multitude of payment methods and processes, and there were limitations to the data that were available at the time of our work. Among our findings, we reached several broad conclusions. First, Minnesota's fee-for-service payment rates for medical assistance dental services are often insufficient, and they do not reflect today's cost to provide dental care. And for anyone new to this subject area, the fee-for-service base rates have been the basis for payments to providers through the managed care programs. We also examined how much dental providers are paid through managed care. Managed care organizations and not DHS are involved in determining how much to pay their providers. We found that on average, managed care organizations do pay more than the fee-for-service rates. And for example, the median payment through the PMAP program was about 120% of the fee-for-service rates. However, we also found that a majority of dentists were in fact sometimes paid at or near the fee-for-service rates. And the fee-for-service rates have not increased for over a decade. For the MA program, we found that the rate setting and payment processes for dental services are complicated by the state's use of multiple payment methods and types of payments. The state's payment policies are poorly coordinated and inconsistently applied across programs. And that one consequence of relying on these multiple types of payments is that it's hard to determine whether the payments supplement or actually supplant rates that are otherwise negotiated between managed care organizations and their providers. We also found that it's very difficult to precisely measure the impact of payment rates on recipient access, again, in part because of the use of multiple payment rates through fee-for-service and managed care. Higher reimbursement rates for dentists have sometimes facilitated patient access to services. However, we think that overall, Minnesota's array of payment policies and rate setting practices likely has had opposing and negative outcomes on dentist participation and on recipient access to services. Among our recommendations, we think that the legislature and DHS should better coordinate payment policies and rate setting for MA dental services for both fee-for-service and managed care programs. As part of this effort, we do think that the legislature should increase the fee-for-service base rates. We don't specify how much they should be increased, but we stress that any increase should be coordinated with rate setting for other types of payments, such as increases in payments to the managed care organizations. And I should note that some of our analysis was based on data collected directly from the managed care organizations. As Mr. Alter mentioned, the legislature has attempted to facilitate the collection of this data, and there have been several iterations of the law pertaining to managed care reporting. Today, the list of information that must be reported to DHS is fairly detailed and extensive, and this is the data that will be the focus of the independent third-party audits required by the 2012 legislature and to be managed by OLA. Currently, we're in the process of developing the framework for these audits, and we anticipate that our work will begin in July of this year. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentations.
And Madam Chair, I wanted to end by echoing that last point, because as some of you know, because you were involved, the Office of the Legislative Auditor was mandated to continue with this work, and that we are, as Ms. Bombach said, in the process of developing our work plan for that, and we will be launching that probably in early July, and we hope that that will again yield some very useful evidence to the legislature and DHS, so that work will soon commence.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Nobles, and we very much appreciate the work that you and your staff do on these really difficult issues, and you've been just invaluable to us over the years. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'm going to call on the Department of Commerce, and I understand that we have a very brief presentation on an audit that they recently completed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Tim Bandy. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Commerce from the Insurance Division. The Minnesota Department of Commerce assisted in evaluating the appropriateness of the managed care public programs, expenses, and reserves. These evaluations were conducted in accordance with an Executive Order 11-06, creating public disclosure for the Minnesota's managed care health care programs, issued March 21st, 2011. The scope and methodology determined jointly with Department of Health or Human Services were as follows. Compare the prepaid medical assistance program detail, which is provided to the Department of Human Services, to the Minnesota supplemental report filed with the Minnesota Department of Health. Verify the Minnesota supplemental report was completed according to the instructions set forth by the Minnesota Department of Health. Perform an analytical review comparing the 2010 and 2011 Minnesota supplemental reports and research any significant fluctuations. Review by total the Minnesota supplemental report to the expense page of the statutory annual statement. Verify appropriateness with regards to the establishment of any premium deficiency reserves allocated to the public programs. Perform retrospective review of reserves established for the public programs at year-end 2009, 2010, and 2011. Compare the 2010 runout provided to the Department of Human Services in 2011 to the retrospective review of reserves completed during this process. These reviews were not statutory examinations, but rather special reviews pursuant to the Executive Order 1106.
Could I just stop you right there?
Sure.
Because you just read a lot of stuff, and I have to say I'm sort of familiar with this, and I didn't understand much of it.
Sure.
So could you kind of give us a recap in maybe in English that most of us
Certainly.
Might understand? Just a real short one.
Yes, ma'am. The The first step was comparing the pre-made or the prepaid medical assistance program detail, which is provided to the Department of Human Services, with the Minnesota Supplemental Report, which is provided to the Department of Health. And the reason for that was to make sure that we had consistent information being provided to both sources, realizing the slight differences of the reporting requirements. Verify the Minnesota Supplemental Report was completed according to the instructions of the Minnesota Department of Health. Helped to verify that that supplemental report, which we could trace into the financial statements, had the was accurately completed and in accordance with those instructions. Performing an analytical review of the 2010 and 2011 expenses was essentially looking at making sure that through analytics that we could understand the fluctuations between the years. Review the Minnesota Supplemental Report to the expense page of the statutory annual statement was again a tie from the Department of Health's Minnesota Supplemental Report to the statutory statements, which we are familiar with as the Department of Commerce.
Okay, you know what, maybe part of this, I think my problem is, okay, and I bet a lot of the members, we don't know what the Minnesota Supplemental Report is. Am I guess? I'm not going to ask you to go through the end. Maybe you could just move on, because
okay.
Kind of just tell us what you're, you know, give us the real overview, if you would.
Okay, so essentially we agreed to the scope of the examinations in order to determine whether the expenses being attributed to the public program were not only accurate but consistent between the Department of Human Services as well as the Department of Health. And so that's what the scope essentially did. Observations that we had, which I'll give some of them, as well as the reports are online for members or anyone to review. There were contributions made to several charitable foundations of the company at year end that were taken from the general administrative expenses of the public program. We noticed that salary allocation methods, we did not identify any caps towards certain salaries that were attributed to the public program. And so essentially any portion of the salary was used in attributing allocation to the public programs, even if individuals' compensation was high. Total administrative costs or administrative expenses allocated and reported fluctuated because of a change in ways of taxes and assessments were allocated between the years. So we did notice some fluctuation related to how they were allocating their taxes. We did look at the premium deficiency reserves. In general, we noted that they were redundant and were conservative. And so when you ran them out, they would have overestimated expenses. We found some findings related to the marketing and advertising, in which they were prohibited from having expenses related to that attributed to the public programs by their contract with DHS. The plans did allocate certain expenses associated with marketing and advertising to the public programs in violation of the contract. We found margin levels in the reserves did not necessarily vary by experience and indication. And as such, we suggested that the margin levels that were put into the reserves should be reviewed more accurately. We found there was some instances of an allocation of lobbying expenses to the public programs. These were not material lobbying expenses that would distort the overall expense. But obviously, lobbying expenses are prohibited by the Department of Human Services contract with the prepaid EMAP system. And then we did find an error in one of the company's supplemental reports that was corrected during the review of these exams. After we reviewed the exams and the findings, we delivered them to the Department of Human Services with the expectation that they would determine whether there was any need or necessity to make changes as a result of the review.
All right, and thank you very much. And let me just ask you one kind of question to put this in context. Is this the first time this kind of review has been done?
Yes, it has. The Department of Commerce does statutory exams for the under a contract with the Department of Health for health maintenance organizations. Statutory exams look at the solvency of the company. And so while we would look at expenses in total, we had no responsibility to look at the allocation of expenses between public and private programs.
Okay, and so just to be really clear about what we're talking about here, members, and please correct me if I'm misstating this. This was an audit that was done when we're talking, when DHS is going toward limiting the amount of profit, even though these are nonprofits, that companies could have from our programs. In order to figure out what's profit, you need to know what the legitimate expenses are that can be attributed to our contracts. And so that's what we're looking at to see whether the expenses that were attributed to those contracts were appropriate and lawful, correct?
That is correct, ma'am.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm just looking around to see if there are clarifying questions, but we're going to move on. And members, we are going to have a chance. We're going to hear from the Siegel Company next, and then we're also going to hear from Scott Leitz from the Department of Human Services. So I'm hoping that maybe Mr. Leitz is going to be able to clear some of these things up at the end if you have questions. And I'm also going to ask I hope the other testifiers can kind of stay in the room so that they can answer questions at the end. Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I didn't discuss with you your plan for today. Usually the plans come down to respond to this. It's funny you're having a hearing. And are they going to come at the end, too, and offer their comments on what's being talked about?
Representative Abler, this is not a public hearing on a bill or a resolution, and so this is simply information being presented by auditors and agencies, and so no. The simple answer is no, but I'm sure they'll be testifying this afternoon or soon in the Finance Committee as we discuss the omnibus bill, and this is just the first of what I expect are going to be a series of hearings. But no, we're not taking any public testimony today from the plans or from anybody else, and believe me, if we open it up, there'd be far more than we could cover today.
Well, Madam Chair, I just think you're customarily very open and fair. And I think this is maybe an exception. I think you should give 5 minutes at the end just to offer a thought. I think that would just be fair.
So. Representative Abler, the people who are testifying today are experts. They are not people who are here with an agenda. And the purpose of having the department testify at the end is simply for them to tell us what they've done in response. So this is not for somebody to have this side or that side. This is to present information that we've contracted for, and certainly the Office of the Legislative Auditor doesn't need a response from somebody. And these are things that are kind of in the public record, and we're just trying to pull it together today for members and the public. So welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here today, and please proceed.
Thank you. Hey, my name is Ken Vieira. I'm a principal at the Siegel Company. First off, I want to really thank and appreciate the opportunity to present our report, and we really appreciate working with the state of Minnesota.
And please pull that mic close to you or move close to it so that we can
maybe
all
I'll
hear
move
you.
Over here, then.
Thank you very much.
Sorry. Different people will do components of the report. Once again, if you didn't hear me the first time, I'm Ken Vieira with the Siegel Company. I'm a principal at the company and the chief actuary in our Medicaid department. Howard Atkinson is also an expert with a firm who's been with Siegel for a number of years and has been in the business for over 30 years. And Dave Mosley, who's with Navigant, has worked on the project with us as well, and we use them as a subject matter expertise on certain elements of the report. So we'll each do a little component of this, and I understand the time, so we'll try to move fairly quickly. I know it's a pretty big report, so we summarized it down and tried to really hit the main elements of the report.
Thank you very much. And the report itself, I know, is quite extensive, and also for those of us who aren't deeply involved in the details of these kinds of audits, that would be very helpful for you to do it at a pretty high level for us. Please proceed.
Okay, so the first thing, we just wanted to briefly summarize that the scope of the audit, which is really we looked at it as a review more than it was an audit. So for the period of 2003, fiscal years 2003 to 2011, you asked us to review the Medicaid programs for PMAP, Minnesota Care, as well as the GMAC program. So we did that review. We also reviewed the requirements and how you met with CMS. Did you meet those requirements? Were you doing things appropriately? Did you meet the definition of actuarial soundness? all those main components. We got a host of data from DHS, probably hundreds of files, so we tried to assimilate that the best we could, and we did release a final report March 28th, about 2 weeks ago. You know, and of course, being an expert, I have to report caveats on the next page, but we do have restrictions and limitations. Obviously, we want the report to be in completion so people can have appendices if the references, things like that. And the data, you know, obviously, we relied on the data that went into that. So all that, I won't spend much time on that, but in general, I had to get that in there. So the next section is we're going to discuss Howard's going to go over the CMS performance.
Sure. Hi, Howard Atkinson, Vice President at Siegel Company. And I'm just going to go over the next section, which deals with some of the main areas that we used as the basis for conducting our review. As Ken mentioned, we received well over 300 documents from the Department of Health, and we assimilated that information. And there are specific requirements that the feds have, specifically under 42 CAFR 438-6, that is affectionately known as the checklist. And so on the checklist, there's roughly seven areas for which managed care organizations that are filing rates would have to comply with. And so in order for rates to be deemed actuarial sound, this information has to be met and present, and it has to be with high integrity. So as you can see, that includes discussing of the overview of the methodology, including the actuarial assumption by, in this case, Milliman was the state's actuary who provided the actuarial certification, the data that was used, the utilization and the cost data. For those of you who don't know, premiums are composed of two components, utilization, price per service, and cost, price per day or per unit of service. And so that information is important for rate development purposes, establishing whatever adjustments may be required in the rating to develop rates going forward, establishing rates by category program, whether it's PMAP, Minnesota Care, or whether it's specific by age, gender, geographic location. All that is required within the federal guidelines in terms of rates and whether or not each specific rate is actuarially sound.
So in general, when we were doing our review, we looked at all these different components and we tried to summarize them in our report. And in more detail in the report, we got kind of references to all these things. But it's fairly specific and prescribed. If you look at the attachment in our exhibit, it'll go through all these components and it'll tell you all the different things that they look at in the regional offices. We won't go into great detail on that.
The next slide just talks about how it defines what is deemed to be actuarially sound in terms of the rate requirements. And so it's basically three categories: rates that have been developed in accordance with generally accepted actuarial practices and principles, rates that are appropriate for the populations to be covered and services to be furnished under the contract, and those rates then have to be certified by an actuary who is a member of the American Academy of Actuaries. The American Academy of Actuaries also provides guidance. It's not a standard operating procedure, but it's non-binding guidance that actuaries use in setting Medicaid managed care rates. And so this was we used this as our basis for our review. They actually have a definition that is worded differently, but has practically the same meaning as the CMS definition. It also describes the checklist and how you can view the checklist, and it discusses the key areas of documentation within that. So, as I mentioned, the American Academy of Actuaries provides a definition that's slightly different, but it pretty much covers the same three things that we talked about previously. So if we now talk about the summary of our findings, I'll just say that we looked at these rates for the PMAP, Minnesota Care, and Senior Program. We are also looking at the rate development for the General Assistance Program, the PGAMC, but this is not the federal state program. This is totally state program, so the federal requirements are not applicable here, so they don't have to be certified by an actuary. There are two approaches. You can actually develop a rate, or you can develop a range of rates. And as long as the rates fall within the range and other things are met, then that would deem actuarial soundness. So as we looked at the rates that have been developed over the period from 2003 to 2011, period that we were asked to review, we found that in the fourth bullet down, that in any given year, standing alone at the time of certification, in our opinion, the rates developed by Milliman, although overly conservative and at the high end of a reasonable rate range, we believe to be actuarially sound in our opinion. But we caveat that in the last, since we did have the opportunity to review this over an extended period of time, that when taken in the context of the prior year losses and gains, it seems unreasonable that no party, either DHS, Milliman, or CMS, called into question the profits over the extended period of the review.
Okay, so the next section, I guess, we want to talk about was plan profitability. And this is kind of, you know, Howard mentioned, in any given period, looking at the rates, you know, you develop rates based on your most recent experience, right? But when you're looking at the over time, you know, you're more concerned with, you know, over time did I hit the optics. So yeah, you may be off a little bit 1 year, but the next year you expect to be a little low, and over time you actually come fairly close to your numbers, right? I mean, that's in the nature to hit it. You know, you're not going to hit it right on, but over time you want to be fairly close. So we did look at the self-reported data, which was in the HMO supplemental report number one that is filed with the Commerce Department, which I think they just discussed. And over the period of our review, looking at PMAP and Minnesota Care, two programs that required actual certification, we found a $430 million profit for those fiscal years. And that's roughly $206.9 million greater than the target amount. So each year, the actuary would put in place a target profit. And you'll see below, it'd be, you know, 2% some years, 0.5% other years, 1%, 1.8. We don't know exactly where those profit margins came from, but in general, those are the targets, so if it was perfect, it would hit that every year. So over the long period, it was about a 1.2% different than what they were projecting. So, you know, 1.2% in general, you know, say 1.2% doesn't seem too bad, but, you know, that's really 100% miss on the profit target. So in general, you want to be pretty close to that over time.
And also maybe worth noting.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Could you please introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, ma'am. I'm Dave Mosley with Navigant Consulting. I'm a subcontractor to these gentlemen.
Thank you.
It also may be worth noting that the profits that are reported, again, are self-reported profits. And what we heard from the Office of Legislative Auditor, as well as Commerce, is that no one has ever gone back and audited those figures on behalf of DHS or the state. So, again, we're looking at the projected profits by the actuary and by the state versus self-reported profits by the plans.
Okay. So I won't go into great detail on this page. I'm happy to answer questions, but in general, just the revenue is on the top and their income, and basically the math just divides it all out, and the target margins are what are in all the actuarial reports, and these are aggregated for those two plans. As you can see, you know, 8 of the 10 years, they had profits greater than expected. You can call it profits, or you want to call it target surplus, margins, whatever the terminology you want to use. There's also a component in this which, you know, some actuaries consider that it should really be integrated into the rate development, which is investment income. There's a significant amount of investment income which really hasn't been factored into this, and $127 million, you know, moves that profit to, I think, instead of 2.4, it's, I think it's 3.1, moves that up, so it makes the deviation variability even greater.
In fact, the CMS checklist actually calls for the investment income to be included when making those calculations.
Okay.
Okay, so that's a fairly large number, and, you know, the profitability, if you won't look at the supplemental report, there's actually other programs in place, too. And one of them was the GAMC program, which it did not require actual certification. It's a state-only funded program. That program over that same period lost $191.7 million over that same period. Now note that there should be no relationship between the GMAC program and the PMAP and Minnesota Care programs, since those rates were required to be actual certified by themselves. So the other component that does require certification, which was difficult to really isolate the true profit report from to the Medicaid agency. It was the Minnesota Senior Health Option. It's an integrated program, Medicare and Medicaid. A large portion of the revenue comes from the Medicare system, and we didn't have any way to break that out in our component. So we just noted that it's a significant additional item, you know, that they made, you know, pretty good financial gain on. But we couldn't break that out for the Medicaid specific, so we didn't include that in those exhibits. Those two have come almost $100 million. It was $98.7 million. I'm sorry. Oh, I thought you asked the question. I'm sorry. And I mentioned below that it was really from the supplemental reports, all self-reported data that I believe is, in the most recent years, they're starting to get reviewed a little harder than they were in the past. Okay, so I did mention the PGAMC program before, and, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about programs and cross-subsidization between the programs. In general, the MCOs were required in their contracts to participate in all the programs. So they had to participate in PMAP, Minnesota Care, as well as the GMAC program. So they had profitable programs that were being offset by non-profitable programs. Now, there was nothing that pointed those at each other, right? I mean, one didn't say you were going to make a profit, so you made a loss, but it did require the managed care organizations to participate in both programs. So what happened over time is that the distribution of the GMAC program within the managed care organizations changed. So certain MCOs got disproportionately hurt by that. So in order to kind of reconcile that loss and spread the loss over all the MCOs equitably, Milliman developed the methodology on how to split that loss out. And technically all they did was reallocate that loss based on PMAP gains and losses, and it had no change on the PMAP or the Minnesota Care rates. So technically, how they filed it with CMS and certifications, all that had no impact on those rates. So there's nothing technically wrong with that. The question, you know, which you said at the bottom was, perception-wise, it does look like, you know, the program that made money, that was funded by the state, that was funded from the feds, I'm sorry, was making profits while the other program was not. So there's, you know, inherently it looks like that because they had a, you know, because they had to participate in both, that you could reasonably assume that there was some sort of target that one was meant to subsidize the other. We don't know the intention. There was a profit margin set in there for the PMAP program. But, you know. Okay, so that's all we can really say on that. Do I talk about?
Okay, and gentlemen, the way we have this funny little procedure here, I know you're not used to Minnesota, but we have to go through the chair, which means I have to call on you each time the different ones of you speaks. And I don't think I got, what was your name again? I'm sorry.
Dave Mosley.
Mosley. Okay, Mr. Mosley, go ahead, please.
Thanks. Over the 10-year period being reviewed, encounter data with paid claims information was never collected by the state. Prior to joining my current firm, I was a partner with a national CPA firm for 9 years, in which period we audited Medicare Advantage programs for CMS, state Medicaid managed care programs. I've had the pleasure of speaking to National Medicaid Human Service Organization, the National Association of Medicaid Program Integrity. I've never seen a state that didn't collect this data. Milliman relied on the certification of the MCO actuary that the data is appropriate for each various request. And although this is deemed, quote, acceptable by CMS, the term acceptable is used in the context of augmenting claims data. Over a period of misses, significant misses, year after year, it would certainly be incumbent upon any professional to call into question whether the methodology being utilized was suspect or the data being utilized was suspect or some combination of the two, because clearly the data and the methodology come together to produce rates which did not pan out in the interest of the state. Not having paid encounter data results in a trend development based solely on MCO self-reported information. And in this case, we're not just talking about dollars. We're talking about whether the individuals being served by the plans are utilizing services which could detect access to care. It could detect certain incidences of morbidity, mortality, biomedical issues that would be looked at across the nation, across the state. It simply provides the state with quite a disservice by not having access to and utilizing it. Again, relying on self-reported pay data for 10-year period seems unreasonable.
in our review of the MCO contracts, it appears that DHS could have had information and should have had this information each and every year. An October 19, 2011 report from Mathematica, of course, surveys a number of states, mentioning those that have been involved in managed care the longest. And again, Minnesota was the only state that was not collecting paid claims data. Utilizing self-reported summary financial data will create greater vulnerability over time, and it limits the effectiveness of the actuary. Having paid encounter data would have provided much greater insight during rate development. And again, there are really three components to managed care. There's the administrative loss ratio, or the administrative component, which heretofore I do not believe the state has ever defined. There's the medical loss ratio, or medical cost, which the state I do not believe heretofore has defined. Then there is profit, which if you know two of the three, clearly you can discern the third. But in the case of Minnesota, there's been no analysis done to confirm the medical loss ratios, the administrative loss ratios, the profits, or the reserves.
And Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, and please give me your name again, sir.
Howard Atkinson, A-T-K-I-N-S-O-N.
Thank you, Mr. Atkinson. Please proceed.
Okay, I just wanted to reiterate that if you go back to the checklist I talked about earlier, that if you read the documentation, you will see that CMS, as well as the American Academy of Actuaries, prefers that the encounter data be used as the basis for rate determination and the paid data associated with that, if at all possible. That is the preferred method for rate development. Going to self-reported claims data, even if it's certified by the plans actuary, would be secondary and would be least preferred.
Thank you. Mr. Vieira, please.
Thank you. We'll try to not mess around that much, so it doesn't.
It does have that effect. I'm sorry about that.
No, fine. Okay, the trend methodology on the next page, it's obviously a huge component of the annual rate increase. It drives, you know, there's obviously other things going on during the rate cycle, but the trend and that rate development is a significant component. There's a lot of work done by Milliman over the years.
And members, we're on page 16, just of the slides. The slides are each number.
Page 15.
15.
Okay. There's two trend slides.
Oh, sorry. Yes, thank you.
And like I say, Milliman did do a significant amount of work, and it was on page 30 of the report. Mr. Mosley mentioned about, you know, using self-reported data, so you know, all their trend analysis really does rely on the self-reported data from the CMO. So I keep saying CMOs, I'm sorry, some say care management organizations. I know you use managed care organizations here. So. The methodology is fairly complicated, and I'll try to summarize as best I can without going overly crazy on the numbers. And we kind of give you a lot of detail on this, but in general, to start out, conceptually, there's a lot of averaging going on. It's an average, an average, an average, and there's a lot of averaging. So the first component that was done was they take those 4 years' worth of self-reported claims data, they develop a cost per member, and they would develop trends year over year for the last 3 years. And then they would, by plan, so Minnesota Care would have one, PMAP would have one, would have their own rate, and they'd average that over a three-year period, so 50% first year, 33% second year, and 17% average those out. So if you get 10, 5, 7, it averages out to 7, or whatever the number ends up being. And that's just one of the starting points. And then on top of that, they then said, let's look at the average of the whole program. So let's look at Minnesota, GAMC, all the programs combined, and let's look at those same trends, weight them again, and that's the second one. Okay, then we take a 50-50 weighting of those two, okay, and that's a new rate. Okay, so from that, we got kind of this three-year weighted average sort of experience trend that they're starting with. Okay? So on top of that, I want to make sure I'm in the right process. Okay. Then after they do that component, which makes sense, they would adjust those rates for any programmatic changes, other adjustments they would need to make, changes in risk, things like that. So they would make all the adjustments that's totally appropriate. Then on top of that, which I think is excellent, they went and they said, let's compare to what we really think trend is, right? Given our actual experience and where the market's going, here's what we think trends are. Makes sense, right? I mean, they average that with the other average, another 50% average. Okay, so now we got this, when all these averages are done, you're to a point where they have a target sort of trend. So with, if no other adjustments are there, those would be the trends they would be using. And as we said below, those ended up being in the 6 to 11% range annually. They range by year. And when we compared them to what we think is reasonable for other Medicaid managed care programs, it seems to us that that's fairly high in relative nature. So a couple big states in the South that we worked with in the past, Georgia and Tennessee, those are both in the 2 to 4% range. And that's not uncommon in a lot of these programs. So our first thought was that, you know, the trends look really high. And we did notice that there was a significant cost component, even in Milliman's target trends, which we thought probably should not be as significant, since a lot of these payments to providers, I don't believe, followed normal cost, commercial cost trends. So they didn't get the normal increases. So in general, you know, they do this component, that's the base trend, and they do a second step. So from that, they did do a look back, right? Which we said, you know, makes sense, right? Over time, you gotta look back and see how you're doing, see if you need to adjust your methodology. So they did do that. They looked back and they looked at how their the surplus amount varied, how much they missed trend in the past. And in the first year of these components, in 2004 to 2008, they made an adjustment for that. So each year they would set these trends, which in our looked like they were on the higher end of a range. They would then go to the following year and see that they possibly they were overstated. So the plan would gain for that year, right? And then the following year they would adjust those trends, and then they do the same thing the next year. So they do the same setup, same scenario, they do the same logic. So we kind of, you know, they're trying to, they did make an attempt to adjust for it. So that was in the first period. And then in 08, they changed their methodology, and in 9 to 11, they employed a methodology which, you know, I think is really, in my opinion, is actually a better methodology. And they actually projected out the claims, looked at how the premiums, what kind of premiums would you get for that? The difference would be your rate increase. The only difference was that the first one was self-reported claims they started with. They projected it at the high claims rate from the other page, and they had different enrollment databases or snapshots that they used for each period of time. So the baseline claims versus the enrollment period were somewhat different, so I think it ended up overstating it. And if you go back to the profitability page, you'll see in, you know, 8, 9, 10, they were, you know, the, probably the most profitable periods for the plan. So I'm not saying it's an exact tie, but maybe the methodology might have had some impact on that profitability. Okay, so yeah, to two different methodologies, and we did say, you know, in general, you know, we have somewhat of a concern for both of them. You know, either methodology uses a very extended period of time to develop the rates. So using 3 years of trends and averaging actually says that you're using claims data from 4 years ago. So for the size of your program, we really think that's probably too long of a time to be looking at to base your trends off of. We already said about the experience data coming from the self-reported MCOs with really no validation of that other than, you know, they did get a certification from the plan actuary that it was appropriate, and like we said, that, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That is an acceptable method. The smoothing, too many smoothing levels, you know, so I mean, when you look at that last year of experience, I mean, it's smoothed out so much, it probably has, you know, like a 10% impact. I'm just throwing 10% out there, but I mean, it's 50% of 50% of it. You know, it's like it keeps getting hit, and it ends up being a real small impact for the claims. I mentioned the disconnect, I think, between certain periods where they did the enrollment database, and for changing populations, you know, if the claim period had a different population mix versus the projected period, that could cause a disjoint. It could be either way. It could overfund it, underfund it, depending on how the population moves during that period. And hopefully I'm not being too technical, I'm trying to get through it. And then the last one, you know, I just think in general the trends look high compared to the marketplace. Okay, I think the next page, I'm on now page 18, we talked about the reliance on MCOs to estimate the benefit changes, and Mr. Mosley already talked about, you know, how unusual it is to not have claims data. And, you know, we look at all the benefit changes over the period, you know, if I look at the 10-year period, there's probably hundreds. Over 100 changes that Milliman had pressed out, and it was a substantial amount of work. And for most of these, it looked like you know, if it required some data, it would be really a request of the managed care organization. So in essence, you're asking the managed care organization, how much do you think this benefit change will impact my program, and then you're going to reduce my revenue from that. So it's kind of like, you know, the cat watching the hen house, or I mean, just, you know, you think, you know, it's almost the I won't go any farther than that, but so of encounter data, we did talk about, did mention that they didn't collect paid encounter. The state did collect encounter data, they just didn't collect the paid cost information. So if we're doing risk analysis and other, they used that data. So they had everything except the paid data. And for utilization-based sort of changes, you could have used up some of the, you could have used that encounter data at some portion of time that does have a usefulness and a appropriate place to be used. So that was never used. I don't know why, I don't know if it was ever, it may very well have been asked for, we don't know that, but we know in history it wasn't used. I also said a lot of these, we really couldn't validate a lot of the benefit changes. I mean, the letters were pretty specific about what the impact was. You know, it was, we'd made this change, it impacted by 0.027% or something, but there really wasn't the data and the any supporting documents that we could really determine that those. I mean, they looked reasonable, but there was nothing that we could really say that they were right or wrong. So in general, we kind of caveated that, you know, probably need to disclose that data to see where it's coming from. So, and that wasn't right. Okay, so the next one is the administrative cost. And I think there's been audits in the states related to this, but in general, it seemed like the process was they would take the prior year self-reported administrative costs and roll them forward at a prescribed trend that was less than the medical trend. So it varied by year, but somewhere between 2% and 4% over the year that they would do that. Loads varied, you know, 7% to 10% over the period. You can see below we have a chart on, you know, what the actual load was, you know, the target versus actual. There didn't seem to be any real critical review of what went into those, which components they were. So it was almost seemed like it was just accepted and used. So from that perspective, we really do think you need an administrative load for a managed organization. It really, should really be a targeted level. What do you think is an appropriate level for a program to operate and to manage a managed care program? And that usually doesn't bounce around over time. It's usually a pretty much set value. Okay. Just one comment on the loads. I mean, in general, I know there's a lot of discussion on it, but overall, the loads are not unreasonable for managed care programs. They're within a range that's not untypical for a lot of managed care programs. So the rate worksheet from DHS, so it's a fairly complicated prospect. Milliman goes through and they develop all this stuff, and eventually they give a bunch of rates to the Department of Human Services that's in their actuarial report. And if you look at any of the certification documents, you'll see a lot of factors and all that. Well, the DHS would then take all those factors, pull them into this worksheet, and we basically just cross-checked. I mean, Milliman signed off to say that they reviewed the worksheet. They thought it worked. We looked through it. It looked like what we could cross-check for certain years. It pulled in the data. Obviously, there's thousands of formulas in this worksheet. There's tabs for, you know, each particular geographic location, the 10 different regions, each of the managed care organizations, you know, and obviously auditing that worksheet is kind of beyond the scope of our review, but we could say it looked like the intent that it was implemented seemed correct. We did go back in time, you know, it's like each year it would build off a prior year, so it would take like the last year and add a factor and just keep increasing it. So at some point we wanted to see where the starting point was. So we went back in a number of cells, went back to the starting point, and were unable to verify the starting point. So, you know, it wasn't everywhere, but there were certain components, a few of those that we couldn't validate. So we do think that in general that worksheet needs to be sort of streamlined a little better, and it needs to have like an audit trail so you can see where everything's coming from. But we do think the intent is that it's operating and functioning as it intends. Okay, the next section we're going to talk about was the risk adjustment methodology. Minnesota was far ahead of other states and was one of the first to implement a risk adjustment system. You know? And I think they have primarily the same system in place today. So, I mean, it's gone on for a long time, and in general, half of the rate that gets paid to the managed organizations is solely risk-based. So it doesn't have anything to do with geography, nothing to do with rate cells, all risk-based. They pay in the following quarter a lagged risk score. So what that those people had a year ago is what they're going to get paid. So if you got a higher-risk person, prospectively you pay them more. You know, it makes sense, right? I mean, that doesn't seem illogical. Problem is, you know, there's a lot of turnover and the risk changes significantly over those periods. So I think the number that I heard from DHS was somewhere around 60% to 65% of the actual risk score comes from those people who are still around. So 35% of it's really based on the averages. So you're really not risk adjusting any of those people. So when risk changes over time, you're really chasing it. You know, if the risk is going up, you're probably underpaying a little bit. If the risk is going down, you're overpaying a little bit. Either way, you're really not paying what that risk is for that period. So, I mean, we believe that the approach was to balance. So basically, the risk system should not pay more or less. It should redistribute to the managed care organizations. So if you have high risk in a period, you shouldn't make more money. You should make proportionally more money. If everybody had this, if all the risk went up in an area, but it went up for everybody the same, there would be no change in revenue for any of your managed care organizations. And the rules for CMS is that you're budget neutral. So a risk system has to be budget neutral and not pay more or less than the average. Okay, so did I have all these? I think I had all these. Okay, so on the next page, I'm on page 22. There was three things that we just, concerns that we had with the system. One is, I already talked about it being prospective, meaning you're paying into the future for what your risk was. The lag nature of that causes you to, like I said, pay different levels. A retrospective system is a system that pays risk in that year for the risk that you have that year. So it's a little different. You'd have to either have a, like some states have a system like that that trues up at the end of the year. At the end of the year, they redistribute based on the risk you had during the year. You could have a prospective approach that then gets adjusted to rebalance. So in general, I think the system itself, you're chasing. And this is kind of the same component with the risk rate. So over time, you have a lot, and I discussed, that you shouldn't get higher premium levels or higher payments for more risk in general. And the one thing that I thought was, concerning, and we're still not 100% confident that it does balance. I mean, I think the intent is to have it be budget neutral and balanced. But in 2008, the system was rebased. I think it was the first time that it was rebased since 2002, I think. And it used 2004 to 2006 data. And it was a sampling, so they used a sample of the data. And they actually sampled the cost data because, we don't have all the cost data, right? So trying to get the weights, you need to have the cost to get the weights, right? Because that's how you're paying it. When they rebased, it was like a 16% change from the prior system, which is a pretty big change, when you think about it. So, and I think they did the appropriate thing, and DHS adjusted the base rate to compensate for that. If it went up 16%, they had to adjust the rate 16% to make it still balance to zero. But I guess my overall concern is, you update the system, that's a huge change. I mean, 16% is a big change, which means that a lot of the risk is totally different than what you had in the past, and your scores are totally different.
Excuse me, Representative Lane?
Yes, I would like some clarification here. You're talking about risk in the system and adjusting it for the risk. And you mean the risk of the people that you're serving, right? How risky they are. You don't mean, so what you're suggesting here, if I'm understanding it, is that if the clients require more medical costs, that we want to make sure that the HMOs are getting the amount they need to cover all that. In other words, in that sense, am I correct to say that the HMOs aren't carrying any insurance risk? They are getting covered on their costs?
Mr. Vieira.
Yeah, I mean, the methodology for a risk system is that you would expect, higher risk patients to require more medical services. And the managed care organizations in the whole rate setting process should get paid more money for that person. Now, in doing that, they're getting paid less money for a person that requires less risk. So overall, they're balanced out to the average. Now, a risk system is meant to redistribute. So if now, just pulling the names out, if Medica's getting more risk than, I'm not saying they're more, but two managed care organizations, one has more risk than the other, they should proportionally get more premium revenue because they got higher risk. And the other one should get less premium revenue. But overall, it's balanced.
Okay. So. Thank you. I'm going to ask to have you finish up the presentation because we do have a number of members who want to ask questions. And Representative Quam has been patient, but is it a clarifying question, Representative Quam?
Well, it actually goes to the point of the slide 23 and slide 11 when they did the timing of the rebasing and they had the in 08 and they used that period 04 to 06. If you look 06 where they had about a 5% loss, the revenues dropped more than twice what they'd been trending up. In other words, 06 was lower than 04 for revenue, and we all know that you staff up and then you have a larger overhead, and if that factor in the rebasing. So I wanted to find out if the timing of the rebasing had a factor. And then when you look at 09, after the 08 rebasing, you see the revenue increased over two times what it had been averaging. And so now you've got quite a bit more revenue, and you probably don't have as much overhead. So I would like to have a feedback as to, is the timing a bigger factor than, you know, some of the other ones?
Okay, thank you, Representative Klum. I think we're starting to get members starting to want to really ask real questions. So if you could just real quickly kind of wrap up the presentation part. And then I also have DHS to just come and kind of finish our presentation. So what I'd like to do is if they can, before, well, maybe we're going to take some questions before we get to DHS. So go ahead, please.
Yeah, I could finish up this quickly. I mean, I already talked about the RIF system. The other piece is the rate cell and geographic variation. We talked about rebasing for the risk. There's also rebasing that goes on every couple of years for the rates, right? You're supposed to have each rate itself is actually supposed to be self-supporting too. So, I mean, if you have a certain rate cell, it's supposed to support itself. So you have geographic differences, you have, you know, all the different rating cells, and all that was redone on the self-reported data as well. So Milliman asked each managed care organization to give data on all of these, and they redeveloped it. So I guess my concern was with this is without a real detailed analysis on why certain regions are more or less, and not having the detailed data that Dave talked about, I think it makes that hard to make sure that is really working right. So that was one other thing. And then the last one was, you know, which I won't spend a lot of details on, is the managed care model. I think, you know, you guys talked about it before, about what your model looks like. There are other models that other states are using, and our recommendation is that you guys just consider or look at the pluses and minuses of each of those potential outcomes. And there's firms that do that, like Navigant and others that do that kind of work. And that's it.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. Please stay. I'm kind of torn a little bit here because I'd like DHS to just sort of very briefly kind of give us where we're at now and where we're going. I don't want to do a real in-depth with them as far as, but I know members have a lot of questions too, and I want to give you the opportunity. So maybe what we'll do, members, is we'll go to questions. I'd ask you to be as brief as you can and ask the responders to be brief, and then at some point I'm going to kind of cut that off and we'll give DHS just the brief finish up, and then if there's still time we can go to more questions.
So, Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. Does that mean they'll actually answer the question I asked?
I hope so, and I hope they were listening to it, because I think we gave them a little time to think about it too. So why don't we, since Representative Quam's question is on the table, I've let him jump the line a bit. Maybe you could answer that one, and then we've got Grunhagen, Fritz, Lane, and McDonald. So if you could just, if you can briefly address Representative Quam's question, Mr. Vieira.
I think there was a lot of things going on in 2008. You had the rate rebasing. You had Milliman changing their trend approach, and you also had the geographic cells and regional cells. And I think all those combined together to make the profits be greater in those years. So I think, you know, we can't isolate which one it was, you know.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I was getting to the point that 06, there was a decrease in revenue. And when you have a sharp drop in revenue, at twice the rate you're increasing, no matter what smoothing, correction, or feedback factors utilizing in your correction algorithm, that would have a discontinuity. And then when you go from 08 and you've made the rebasing to 09, and now you have a much larger increase in revenue than you had been running, would those two timings exacerbate whatever control function had, no matter how well or actually sound? So I'm talking about the revenue, not the process and the timing.
And Mr. Vieira, Representative Quam is an engineer, so I'm telling you that because whatever you say might not, the rest of us might not get it.
Yeah.
And you could, you know, I'm actually going to suggest this is more technical, Representative Quam, and I'm not sure the rest of us are going to follow the answer. So I guess, gentlemen, if you can stay around a bit, I wonder if you'd have a chance to talk with Representative Quam
offline,
unless you have a really simple answer to that question.
I don't. I think it would probably be good to talk offline.
Thank you very much. Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to be brief and to the point. Just a couple observations based on the testimony is, one, I think, you know, the plans brought a certain amount of stability, predictability, and they weren't mandated by law to do this. This legislature mandated them in order to do the PMAP. When it looks at fee for service by DHS versus PMAP, they're paying out 120% higher on average based on testimony that we had here today. So they're actually doing a better payout than what the government is. Secondly, obviously there's some problems, you know, the advertising marketing expenses, the lotting expenses being shifted over to their Department of Commerce highlighted those. But really, when I come down to all this, and by the way, I spent over half my political life the first 2 years on this issue, okay, and still wasn't able to come up with a solution, it seemed. But really, when it comes down to it, based, and by the way, an excellent presentation, I really appreciate it. It was the self-reporting of the HMOs. What the state was, you know, the HMOs did everything they were required, but ultimately the state allowed them to self-report.
Representative Grunhagen, is there a question
yep,
here?
Yep, here it comes.
Please.
Okay. Get ready. Now, so to me, it's the state that has a lot of fault by not making requirements when they've seen these trends of 6 to 11% versus 2 to 4% annually, which you talked about. So the point is this. On page 3 of your report, not slide 3, but page 3, you indicated that this is a cost-plus program. And under federal law, based on the information I have, that means that it should be audited once a year under GAAP accounting rules. Isn't that true?
Mr. Mosley.
Thank you. Actually, if you look at 42 CFR 447.202, which I think is what you're referring to.
I just looked at it yesterday, by the way.
it does say that if a Medicaid program is paying based on cost or cost plus, that the state has a responsibility to provide reasonable assurance of audit of the underlying data. And there's question, and it's been raised back and forth. Of course, the term actuarial soundness doesn't have any basis in the American Academy of Actuaries. It's a term that CMS made up. And the Academy has done its best to address that. The response that has come forth from CMS is once these gentlemen, which are actuaries, touch it and do their magic, that it's no longer cost plus. It is forecasted and trended. So, as someone who just left a CPA firm as a partner for 9 years, I agree with you wholeheartedly. However, there's question at CMS as to whether what you're saying, and I happen to agree with, holds water and that CMS will ever hold folks accountable. The real problem is not only was the data not verified or audited, the state never even received it.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen, I've given you a big chunk of time to make a statement.
One quick follow.
Real quick.
Okay. In your report, did you believe that the rates were inflated to cover the losses of GMAC as indicated in your report? I don't have the page number right in front of me.
Mr. Vier.
Good question. I think that the profit margins that were targeted for those other programs were set in totality to make a managed organization whole. It would seem logical, since they had to participate in all the programs, that as a businessman, the financial people with the managed organizations would have looked at it in totality. So I think those profit margins were probably set to take that into account. I mean, it just seemed logical. I don't know how it couldn't be.
All right. Thank you. Representative Fritz.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is with Representative Grunhagen, because I too wanted to know if this was a cost plus contract, and shouldn't there be an annual audit accompanying that? And also the $30 million that when UCARE gave us back the overpayment, was that the red flag? Was that what, when the lights and sirens went off, and if it hadn't been for that, we wouldn't be here, would we?
Representative Fritz, I'm not sure these are the right people to answer that portion of it, but maybe you could answer
well,
the
if
first
they were the
part.
If they were doing an actuary for us, perhaps they could answer the first part of that question.
Right. Mr. Vieira.
The cost plus. I mean, it's not a cost plus contract.
Mr. Mosley.
Thank you, ma'am. I believe the underlying issue you're getting to is that there's a medical cost, there's an administrative cost, and on top of that, there's profit. So in a layman's terms, it is medical cost, administrative cost, plus profit on a PM-PM basis. And I have to tell you that when you get the actuaries involved and you have prognostication based upon a series of forward-looking assumptions, it becomes different than cost plus. But I certainly appreciate what you're saying. One of the key issues, though, is that in any event, the state never defined what allowable medical costs were, nor did it define what allowable administrative expenses were. So any reporting of profit would be subject to non-quantifiable definitions for the two underlying cost criteria.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mosley. And I think that's what our Commerce reporter was telling us as well. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick question is, did you ask for cost-paid data? Did you ask for some of that?
Did we
Mr. Vieira?
Yeah, we asked for encounter data. I mean, it's not available, so we're not going to get it. And that's not something it's not a simple process for an actuary to use. It's a large amount of work.
Yeah, I think one of the first things that we had asked Milliman was the availability of rates and the data that they used to develop the rates under the assumption that they had that information available.
Yeah, actually, you know,
Mr. Vieira, I'm sorry, you need to go through the chair.
For most of these certifications, there's typically a data book that goes behind it, and it's all the details. So you see the rate buildup, the per unit cost, all that stuff. And I guess from our perspective, we were really surprised when we were doing the audit that there wasn't any data books. Really. I mean, there was really just some really level data that went into it. And it actually really was just rate changes. You know, it was like trend impact, things like that.
Okay, a quick question. Just need verification that I'm thinking right here that if we can't verify what the medical costs actually, or if we can't verify what the administrative costs actually were, so therefore we can't verify what the actual profits actually were, then we can't verify what a cap on a reserves will actually bring back to us. We can't verify audit results is actually showing us what program works better and what program doesn't. What good is any legislation that we do if we don't have this basic data? Am I right in thinking that we're kind of like a cat chasing our tail?
Mr. Vieira, are we a cat chasing our tail?
Maybe not a cat, dogs chase tails. Cats, I don't think they chase tails. But in general, I think you really need to get the data. Now, the actuary does sign off on that, so I know it's not validated, but plan actuaries who, you know, they're working under standards of actual practice, right? They're certifying that they believe that the data is correct, so, which is what Milliman relied on. You know, it's just, you know, being an actuary, I know that over time, you know, when you do certain things, and if you're working for an HMO, I mean, it needs to be checked. So an independent party needs to check.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, Grunhagen asked my question.
Oh, okay. All right. Other questions, members? All right. I'm not seeing any, so let's go to DHS. Thank you very much, and please do stick around and to talk to Representative Quam and I'm sure other members as well. And we may have more questions for you at the end, please. Mr. Leitz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Scott Leitz from the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, I know that I do have a presentation, but I know that your time is relatively short, so I'd be happy just to maybe kind of hit on some of the highlights of the things that we have implemented since taking office to address, I think, some of the very good work that Siegel has done here. We knew coming into office, quite frankly, Madam Chair, that there was a great deal of room for improvement in how the work was being done around rate setting. And it really was the first item that we undertook as the Dayton administration to improve the way that we were doing our business. And I spoke before this committee a number of times around the efforts that we've undertaken there. I won't rehash them in great detail, other than to remind you, for the last contract that was negotiated under the previous administration, we negotiated a 1% cap on profits that returned money to the state. And then we moved away from our traditional, from the way the previous administration had set rates to a competitive bid process starting in 2012. And that was a process that we competitively bid in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. We took the results of that, moved them statewide. saving about $175 million in state funds. And then for our 2013 contracts, we've really tried to use the results. We've taken the results from that 2012 competitive bid, used it as the base, and held rates flat for 2013. We also had a very high focus on creating transparency around this program. This has been one of, I think, some of the questions that you're asking today grow out of the fact that it's a very complex program over time. We've attempted to cut through that by trying to create a transparency within this program that hasn't existed previously, including having information available to the public on our website specific to this program. But under the governor's executive order, we also undertook a series of audits. You heard from Deputy Commissioner VandeHay earlier about the Commerce Department audits that were conducted earlier this year that really were looking at whether the allocations of administrative expenses were appropriate for the programs involved. And we also contracted, obviously, for the audit that you just heard about with the Siegel Corporation. But I want to cut to a point that Mr. Mosley talked about, and that's really as it relates to paid claims data. I want to make a very strong point here, and that is that DHS for many, many years has collected encounter data. I think there's some confusion about that. Data has been collected for many years on encounter data. What was never collected before was paid data related to the encounters. And we began that process in 2011, shortly after taking office. We full well understood the point that they were making and frankly understood it very well. That for us to be able to operate a good program, a program that had responsibility and accountability back to the public and to the legislature and to the taxpayers, we needed to know what was going into the underlying information. We have begun to collect that data, and starting with our 2014 contracts, that data will be used to cross-check information and to be the basis for how we're doing our rate-setting process. So we very much agree with that finding. We think it's an important finding, and we think it's one of the most critical things that have been done in the last year. One thing that I would like to also note for you is that since taking office, we've used a variety of methods, including the 1% cap and including competitive bidding, to really meet the profit targets that were put in place each year that we've done this. And we believe we're on track to do that for 2013 as well. So I'm going to ask members, if it's okay, Madam Chair, to just, if I could, a couple minutes to walk you through some of the results that we've achieved since taking office. And so on page 3 of the presentation you have in front of you is a look at Minnesota Care and PMAP rates over the course of the past 7 years. And I want to just highlight a couple of things. One is on the top where it says, there's the fifth row down where it says average PM. What that is that's the per member per month capitation rate that's paid to managed care plans to manage our programs. What you see is that grew at a rate of between 8 and 10% from 2008 to 2010. Starting in 2011, you actually saw a reduction in that rate as we negotiated caps on growth and capitation, the effects of the competitive bid process, and for 2013, the effects of taking those results from competitive bids and holding those rates flat for the 2013 contracts. We're now in a situation in Minnesota where we're actually paying less per member per month in capitation in 2013 than we did in 2010. We've literally lowered capitation rates, and that is a result of using efforts to really meet our targets. Madam Chair, on the next page, page 4, this looks at 2011. Again, this was the last year of contracts negotiated under the previous administration. Commissioner Justin did negotiate a voluntary 1% cap on profits with the plans. What this slide shows is that the operating margin for 2011 without that cap was 4.7%. That meant that 3.7% of margin was actually paid back to the state under that 1% cap. And so that resulted in about $105 million being paid back to the state under that negotiated 1% cap. For 2012, looking at operating margins, and again, I'm focusing on operating margins because that's something Siegel pointed out as an area that we should be actually looking at. This is the year that we did competitive bidding. And what we did in the competitive bid is we said we effectively reset the base of how capitation was done by asking help by saying to the health plans, we're bidding out the 7-county metropolitan area, and we'll be taking the per member per month bits that you give us, and that will be the basis of the capitation that's paid. What this did was effectively reduce not only below what the forecast was, the amount that was being paid, but below what we were actually paying the previous year. We literally reduced the amount of capitation out of that competitive bid. And when you look at the operating margin that came out from that in 2012, it really hit the target that we had put in place, which is around 1%. And so that's what we were able to do for 2012. For 2013, Madam Chair, we took that same result of looking at the results from that competitive bid, and we held flat the capitation rate increases. So there was no capitation rate increase overall for these programs in 2013. We believe that will also result in 2013 in a very reasonable margin being earned by the plans doing the work that they do. All told, on page 6, when you sort of, what does this all mean for the state's budget? Well, it has had a very large impact. So on page 6, basically what this shows is when we went and looked at what the forecasted rates were for the November 2010 forecast, the last forecast before we came into office, and then compared that to the amount of per member per month change in capitation that was paid as a result of the 1% cap and the competitive bid results. All told, those changes combined have saved about $1 billion to the state in terms of actual budget savings to the state relative to what the November 2010 forecast was. Madam Chair, I'll just close by talking very briefly about the Siegel audit and the findings from that audit and what we're doing to implement those. I mentioned earlier the importance of the encounter data. We recognized that this was a critically important aspect of what we needed to have and what we needed to collect. So we began efforts in early 2011 to obtain high-quality usable data from the plans. Again, DHS has always collected encounter data. What was missing from that data and what we remedied starting in May of 2011 was that we actually started to collect payment data associated with those encounters. What we discovered in 20, as we started to work with that information, was that it was not, there were a number of data accuracy issues related to the data we were collecting from the health plans. These are 30 million encounters that are coming into the state, and so when we actually started to look into the data, we discovered there were errors in that information. So over the course of the last year, we've been working very closely with the health plans to actually correct up that information so that we have accurate and usable and analytically good data, so that starting next year as we start to do the rates, we'll actually be able to use encounter paid data for the first time in helping to actually set the rates. A couple of other things I'll just mention at a high level, Madam Chair. I have to say that we in each of the recommendations that Siegel brought forth agree fully with them. They're very good recommendations. They, in many cases, are recommending things that we have either already implemented, such as collecting the encounter data, moving to a new risk adjustment system, changing the way that we do rate cells in geographic areas, or that we have a very strong intention to do through the work that we're doing moving forward. I think that their finding related to medical cost and trend inflation we take very much to heart. I think that they look that their finding that we had used that the department previously in past years had used trended data that was averaged over a number of years led to inaccurate and inaccurate information and not as good information. For 2012, for example, we're just using, for 2013, we used only 6 months of 2012 data to actually do that. So we tightened up that period in a way that got rid of the smoothing that they talked about that led to some of the inaccuracies. So we really see this report as something that we can very strongly use. We appreciate the work that Siegel has done. I'm happy to go through the various areas, Madam Chair, as this presentation does, but I know in the interest of time, you'd probably prefer that I just summarize what we've done.
And Mr. Lights, I've got a question, too, from Representative Schoen. I don't know, do you want to, maybe you can just quickly finish up and then we'll go to his question.
And Madam Chair, I will just close there and say I think that we very much look forward to continue to work with the legislature. I think we've put in place a lot of reforms that have already had a lot of impact, but I think we see a lot of some additional opportunity moving forward.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lights. I've got Schoen and Loeffler, and I think that's all we're going to have time for. Mr. Schoen.
Madam Chair, if Representative Loeffler has a specific question for DHS, I'll defer. My mind is going to be a broader-based question.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my concern was, well, you know, the discussion has focused primarily on the financial data and the fact that you did not have encounter-level financial data. We always say we want to purchase, whether it's in the market for others or, you know, as for public coverage, based on cost and quality. And your data warehouse has tremendous amounts of encounter data that I have felt like the state has tremendously underutilized. And it felt to me like when you rebid the Metro contracts, which is over half the state and over half the population, that wealth of history about who's actually delivering the care, doing the best job of outreach, doing the best in terms of preventative care and not having situations escalate in mental health or other areas that are high cost, I didn't see that being used. And I'd like to hear a little bit about, while you're doing all this good work cleaning up the data on the financial side, what are you doing on the quality side so we actually know what we're buying and whether we're getting quality care?
Yeah, Representative Loeffler, you know, I think that's a great question, but I think we're a little beyond the scope of this hearing, and I know Mr. Leitz is going to be before us probably sooner than he would like.
Okay.
In another committee, so would it be okay if we...
I would be glad to defer that. I just really would like to do that because I think it's both sides of the coin, and I think we need to ultimately understand both.
Okay. And Madam Chair, just to... Loeffler, Mr. Leitz.
I won't go and answer the question fully, but other than to say we very much agree with you, Representative Loeffler, have invested a great deal of resource in building up our ability to do just what you're starting to talk about, and I'll be very happy to talk in more detail about what we're doing in that area.
Okay. And Representative McDonald also has a question. Do you want to still wait, Representative Schoner? You want to ask right now?
If Representative McDonald has
all right.
For,
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Question, Mr. Leitz, are we going to try to recover the $207 million that was overpaid to our programs? Is that one of the plans that will hopefully recover some of our taxpayers' dollars?
Mr. Leitz.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, that isn't an item that's in the governor's budget this year. We do know that moving forward, we're going to be looking at our rates really, really closely and are going to be working to do our best to make sure that we aren't missing targets on the high side, as has been done in the past. I think we've managed to achieve that for 2012 and 2013. Mm-hmm. We understand that there will likely be discussions as part of the legislative debate moving forward, and so, you know, we'll be here to help with technical assistance and other things as you move things forward.
Thank you, Mr. Leitz. Representative Schoen.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, thanks for asking the question I was going to add. I think discussions might be the nice way to put it. You know, I think we had a plan that, $30 million, and they said, whoops, we overdid it. Where's the rest of those plans that did that same exact thing, because they're not that one isn't the only one. So I guess I'm looking for the roadmap of what happens when we go forward, and if there's a synopsis, if you have any idea. I'm new, but I'm flabbergasted. And there's some people that should be ashamed. And thank you to this administration for getting ahead of this and looking and starting the fix. But, man, what a road we've got to go. And I can't wait to find out the rest of the information, because there's going to be some dirt coming up, I feel.
Thank you, Representative Schoen, and members. And this, I just want to say that this has bipartisan leads. There's been a lot of concern about this issue. There are a lot of dollars here. As I said at the beginning, these are our Minnesota patients, and all of us, I think, want to make sure that every dollar we spend is used appropriately to buy health care for people who are entitled to that care, and that we don't waste any more taxpayer dollars. It's quite clear that we have in the past. And so I think, members, thank you very much, and look forward to continuing on this topic. And thank you to all of the presenters. And there will be further work on this, I am sure. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.